Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Source with Don and Till. Today, Till is interviewing Don. So I feel like we often do a million interviews and we're asked the same questions over and over again, which is fantastic for new audiences. But for you guys that know us already, there are some questions that I'm sure you guys have wanted to know the answers to. I put up a question box for Don on my story today. I've been bombarded with questions. People want to talk to you. They want to know the answers. So introducing Don.
Well, thank you so much, wife.
I'm actually so excited.
It's such a privilege to be on the podcast with you. And I'm just super grateful to be here today.
I know you've been a long-term fan, long-time listener. And I'm glad we could finally make this happen.
You are actually on some other bullshit today. Today's a funny day.
Yeah. So today we're just going to chat with Don. And it's business focused. I was going to prepare my own questions, but I didn't need to because you guys came through with so many. I've put them into little sections so I can introduce the kind of section as well. And we can just answer questions and chat about things along the way.
Yeah, I like it. I like that we're able to actually bring a podcast that might add some specific value.
Yeah.
I've been enjoying the chit-chats lately. I really enjoy the pressureless chit-chats, but I'm excited.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Let's get into it.
Let's kick it off. So, if you guys don't know, Don is the founder of Stack, started the business
really
in 2015. Yeah, it's leading into my
first question.
I'm the host here.
Go again. Oh, I'm literally the guest.
Treat me like the host.
Okay.
Yes. Nanny just looked at me like, oh, Dad, you're in trouble.
We are in shit.
Okay. So how much did it cost you to start Stack in 2015?
Straight into the money section. I've never sat back and I've never done the figures. I think that the challenge is, I remember specifically in 2015, that was when I was the brokest. That was when I'd had, I think, you know, the number is, I think, 80,000. I think that's how much debt we were in at that point.
I hadn't met you in 2015. That was all you, baby. Did we meet in 2016?
That's so right. Yeah. I've got to get my timelines right.
Don't try and split your debt with me. That was you. 80K you.
No, but I was still broke when we met anyway. Yeah, at that point, it's a hard one because I had no money. I think I remember spending money on the Shopify registration, which was about $70 or $80 at that point. And all the collections I was dropping was done in the pre-sale model. So even at that point, I didn't have cash in bank to go and buy the collections. I remember, if I have to sum it up, I probably did everything for under 10 or 15K, which included the trip to China.
Did you have that money, or that was all credit card?
There was no forward cash. Everything was credit. Everything was debt at that point. So to start, it was very little, actually. I think it was just a couple of registrations here and there, and I started the website, and I sold everything on pre-sale. So realistically, not much.
What does pre-sale mean?
Is that the question?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Sorry, I'm feeling like I've been getting interrogated by my wife. Wow, why am I sweating? Pre-sale is when...
Did you invent the term? Before you, I had never heard of pre-sale.
I think it's broad to make a claim saying that I invented it. But
of course,
when I was doing pre-sale on the website back then, no one else was doing it. And I remember the functionality didn't exist on Shopify. So I actually had to get these developers offshore through Upworks. That's a hack if you guys are ever looking for people to do any trades, works online in web development or graphic design. I use Upworks and sometimes I still do if it comes to looking for like little tech spurts online. So I remember getting some guys to help me write these scripts on Shopify to allow us to take pre-sale and sell in oversell. So what that means is I would photograph a blank t-shirt and I would Photoshop my logos on the t-shirt, put it on the website, and I'd sell it without having inventory. And we would say to customers, hey, we'll have the product in 4 to 6 weeks. You know, everyone loved the product that much at that time. And they were buying it with absolutely knowing that they will wait because that's the only way you could get Stacks at the time. And that's the pre-sale model.
Yeah. So I want to commend you on the community. I think that you would have built already. The fact that people trusted you enough to give you the money before the product came and they were happy to wait these 4 to 6 weeks, goes to show the brand value that Stacks already had in Perth.
And I think that's the most important thing. You know, a lot of people start businesses or they start online businesses and they think, I'm going to start an online business and I'm going to sell hundreds of t-shirts. I only started the website so that I could collect payment. I remember all the sales, all the hustling was done, you know, by word of mouth and hand-to-hand combat. And what I mean by that is I was calling people up. I was messaging people in Messenger, closing sales and selling.
I know people still screenshot me those first messages that you would send back in 2015.
That's like really putting me on. Yeah, no, I think that's so important. I think that's something everyone needs to realize. I think you're fooling yourself if you think you're going to start a website, you know, download Shopify, teach yourself how to edit it, and then start making sales. You have to still make sales. It's a whole different category of operations. Like just because you have an online website, and that's where I think a lot of people get despondent. That's where I think a lot of people, they get sidetracked and they get disappointed when they don't make sales and when it doesn't work out, because you start the website as a way to absolutely just take the payment and close the payment. You still have to do all the sales and marketing on the other side of that.
So two questions from there. How did you get out of 80K worth of debt? Like what was the strategy? What was the plan? How did you keep going?
There wasn't a plan. I think when you're in that space, the only option you have is to make as much money as you can and pay it off. And that's what we did. You know, fast forwarding, I was working four or five jobs. It was four jobs and I would literally do, because I couldn't take one full-time job. I had to take a job that would allow me to work these crazy hours. So I had time to do stacks in between. So I do around three different jobs a day with 4 hour shifts. And in between, do my deliveries, have time to build the website, have time to do customer
DM
service,
people.
DM people. It was almost like a twofold approach. One was the business was just keeping itself alive and I was working these hours to keep myself alive and pay off the debt. It was just a laser sharp focus mission over time.
I know you said as well before, you didn't have any other option. Like you would just like you would wake up and you would work because that was the only thing like you had to. Like you had to get yourself out of the debt.
There wasn't an option. Like what options do you have? What do you do when you're in that space? You just have to get up and work.
Was it hard? Did you struggle with mental health?
Yeah, I think 100%. I remember when the supplement shop didn't work out and it was probably just before I met you and through the first couple of months of us, you know, first meeting, I was probably at the lowest point in my life because I'd felt like I'd lost everything. But simultaneously, I have two sides in my brain. Like the other side was like hustle, 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 work. It's always going to work out. So every day was a daily fight of I feel shit, I couldn't be bothered, I hate this, blah, blah. And the other side that was motivating myself internally was work. Like, let's go, it's going to work out. We just got to put our head down and block out the noise and just keep pushing and pushing and pushing.
I think something that I found really attractive about you when we first met, and obviously I still do, is that you never seemed like you were struggling. Like, you always showed up. You always a happy personality. You were always doing your best. Like you didn't just give up. And I think like, obviously people are allowed to struggle and to go through tough times, but that's something really commendable is that you always just turned up and you gave it your all no matter what was happening in the background.
That was a conversation we just had with our team recently, right? It's like when you've made, I think that's one thing I've always believed in. When you make a decision, you show up, you have to commit. So, you know, even at that point, like everything on the one side wasn't working out. It was a shit phase. Like it was hard. I had no money to do anything. Like I didn't even have money to run the business. But when people ask, how did you make it work? Honest to God's truth, I don't know. I think I blacked out all of the noise and I blocked out all of the doubt. And you just focus. You don't give up. You show up every single day. So I think people can definitely have depression, anxiety, and these bad phases. But you can also push yourself and you can also get through it.
Mm. Bit like the pinata theory that we spoke about last week.
You just keep pushing. It's that
you
meme.
You keep hitting that pinata.
It's that underground meme when that person's digging and you might not see the gold on the other side, but if you just keep going, you're bound to hit it. I always believe that. I think the other thing is people get sidetracked with comparisons. You know, people compare themselves to other people that are already doing what they want to do. They think two things. One, it's easy and it was easy. You know what I mean? People think that even being in this position, okay, cool, like we've done it, we've made it, the brand's killing it, blah, 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 it's easy, we must have a great life. But the pressure and the stress and the work doesn't stop.
That was one of the questions. It says, is running a business harder now that it's bigger? And what are the differences and challenges?
I think hard is hard in principle. I think the challenge now is the pressure. I think back then, I only had to think about myself. And then when you came into my life, I had to think about you. So my focus was thinking about the two of us. I knew that if it didn't work out, I could find a job and I could support us. Mm. You could work and it would support us. When you run a business at scale and you have, I think we have 6 stores now, 120 staff, it keeps growing. You have all these commitments. There isn't a job I could do that can support this. Do you know what I mean? So it's, you know, the pressure you have every single day of like, well, if I fuck up, if I have a bad day, or if I don't do something right, you fuck it up for everyone. Like there's 100 plus people that are dependent on me being...
making smart decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the pressure's way more intense.
Have you ever had times where sales were low and how did you navigate that?
I think a lot of what we do is seasonal. You know, a lot of the revenue comes in when we drop these massive collections. So you have these phases where it peaks and troughs. So you'll have these phases where it's like, here's an example. You have Black Friday sale and you have the May sale.
Stacks Friday.
Stacks Friday is insane. It is huge. We've been doing...
They all know. They all shopped it.
You guys know. You do the numbers and you do the comparisons to a lot of brands and it is just insane what had happened. The amount of inventory we pushed out and the amount of people that shopped is still mind-blowing to this day. But so what happens there is... every single person in our community has shopped.
Mm-hmm. A few times.
Like 3 or 4 times because it's such a great deal. So naturally what happens after that, there's like this massive sale drop-off. You know, the 2 or 3 weeks while everyone's waiting for their orders to come through, you know, sales are really poor. That's a natural thing, but that's when the anxiety kicks in. I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. Fuck, like, are we going to lose it all? Is it just not going to work out now? Is everyone done with stacks?
Because it doesn't necessarily matter what we did yesterday. Like, we have daily goals and that's the, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, just because we had a massive day yesterday doesn't mean that we can make no sales the following day.
No, and that's when I'm talking to people about cash flow, if we have a bad month or 2 bad months, that's really bad for a company. Like, most companies work this way. Most people don't realize, like, you could make... got however many hundreds of thousands of dollars you want, but we're not Apple. We're not Coca-Cola. We don't have generations or years of savings and resources. We still go month to month. If you have a bad month, you have all these expenses and these bills to pay. You know, once you've paid for your taxes and once you've paid for all the expenses, you can't afford to have a bad month because it's just business. Like if you have bad months, the business is doing bad.
What happens when you do have a bad month or what have you learned to do?
Well, here's the key. I think one of the best things that ever happened to me was learning how to figure it all out and not have. That phase I went through, I'll never wish this upon anyone. But I think anyone that has been in a phase in business where they've lost everything and they've been broke and they've been in debt and they've had banks calling and they've had, you know, the ATO on their back and they've had sleepless nights, you're programmed differently. You're wired differently. You've experienced and you've tasted rock bottom. And once you get to that space, you realize you never want to be there again. And this is not something you can teach anyone. So people that have been in that space will understand this. But if you can imagine, once you've been in that space, you'll realize you never want to be there again. So you do everything you can to never get even close to that space. So within the way I run the business, I have triggers. I have operative indexes or keys of, let's say, sales that I know we can hit. And I'll never... bite off more than we can chew. We'll never take risks I'm not confident we can do. I'll never spend money I'm not confident we can make back or reinvest. So I think one of our strategies is to make sure that we don't bite off more than we can chew. Don't spend more than you have. We still have a very disciplined approach to how we run the business.
So if someone is looking to start a clothing business, this is another little section of my interview questions. How do they start? Do they use Alibaba to find manufacturers? Is that how you started?
I would honestly, it depends on the type of product you're looking for, right?
Say it's a t-shirt.
If it's a t-shirt, I would 100% find a local manufacturer that do blank t-shirts because I think...
So someone in like Sydney for us?
Yeah. Here's the thing. I think you have to be very clear about what you're trying to create. Are you trying to create a brand or are you trying to create a business? And there's two very different things. And I'll do a podcast one day that explains the difference. I think it's too complex. So I've got a lot to speak about if we did that. But... why I'm saying that is because if your interest is to build a brand, get some plain t-shirts, get some blank t-shirts from, guys, here's the tip, go to AS Color and buy some blank t-shirts from them and take it to a screen printer and print your logos on it and then sell it to your friends and your community and build a brand. Build, because you know, at the end of the day, you can find some cool basic t-shirts and build a cool brand. Once the brand develops and evolves, that's when you start going and looking for manufacturers to do your creative. All right, here's the difference. if you want to start a fashion label and you only want to build a very simple aesthetic of, let's say, you know, silhouette denims or a particular product that is super unique, then you go to China and try and find suppliers. You can definitely try and find manufacturers in Australia first, but it's really hard. There's not a lot of factories that want to do low minimum order quantities. You have to probably buy 300 to 500 minimums. I would strongly urge you guys not to do that at first. You got to be sure you can sell those units before you go that route.
So how many units would you suggest as a starting point?
Small. Make sure you can sell 10.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, 20.
Once you flip the 10, go out and do the 20. Once you've done the 20, go out and do the 30. Don't ever be fooled and think you're going to, in your first sales. Here's the thing. Here's what I've seen happen quite often. I see, let's say it's someone that's got a decent following online or whatever it is, or a micro influencer, you know, they'll have a bit of buzz and they'll start this and they'll come up with these really cool hoodies and they might order in a couple hundred from Alibaba or from whatever the manufacturer is. And it has its like 3 minutes of fame and everyone loves this hoodie, but they've overcommitted and they can't follow it up with a second drop or a second collection. Always play the long game. Always start small and grow into something. Give yourself a couple of years to build into it.
When it comes to finding suppliers, is there anything to like look out for or any like bad signs?
I don't think there's really bad signs these days. I think if you're using a platform like Alibaba, the cool thing about Alibaba is it's not just focusing on China. I think that's a misconception. There are a lot of suppliers worldwide that will have their products on that website. So these days, a lot of it is vetted. The platform actually has trade assurance, so it actually protects your investment. So even if you don't get your product, you can claim against the insurance on the platform. So
there's some safety there.
There is a lot of safety. I think you just have to realize, you know, look at it from the other side. You're probably one of 5,000 people a day that wants to start a brand and you're going to bug these factories. 4,700 of them are just time wasters. So you've got to persist and be super respectful to the other side and realize you're very small and they think you're a time waster. So you just have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and building
politely pushing.
Super politely and building that relationship.
Do you think it's worth investing in samples before doing a bulk order at the start?
100%. Absolutely. You should never, ever commit to a bulk production. So here's what you need to do. You need to find a supplier, figure out if they're willing to share what are the brands they've made stuff for, if they're willing to share their catalog of product, order a couple of product from them and pay their fee, pay their sample fee. They have to run a business. Order a couple of samples from their catalog, assess their workmanship, and then you could send your designs in and work with them to create your design, get your designs back, assess the sample. Then you can commit to your production. But here's the tip. Always order a pre-production sample. So you'll pay your deposit for your production. And before they commit to the production, get them to make you another sample. It's called pre-production. And then before you pay for your final product or before you pay for your final bulk collection, order a post-production sample to vet that all the product is correct. And then once you receive that post-production sample, you can pay the final balance and then they'll ship the goods.
Hot tip. Absolutely never order in bulk without a sample. That's a disaster.
Strict rule. Unless, for example, you're in our position where our factories now is like...
Oh, yeah. I mean, like starting out.
Yeah. As a startup, never, ever commit to bulk. Then, and by the way, you might find that a factory will try and push you to it. You know, they can get really pushy. Stand your ground and protect your investment, always.
How long does sampling take? How long did it used to take? How long does it take for stacks now?
We have our own factory, so you know we can turn samples around in a week. You know, back then you usually give yourself 2-3 weeks. It just depends on the volume. And again, when you're starting out, you just have to have patience and you have to be very particular in what you want.
Yeah, you have to know what it is that you want.
And be able to communicate that. You know, don't assume that the other party will just get what you want to do.
So, next chapter. I feel like I'm a good little interviewer here.
No, I think so. I've never been... I feel like I'm on...
You're really in the hot seat.
I am. I'm under pressure today.
I am here. I've been watching the Vanderpump. Like, I am here to get the answers.
No, well, I don't know. I feel like you're Andy Cohen and...
Yes.
Well, I don't know which side of the seats I'm on, but I'm getting grilled.
You can be Ariana.
Okay.
So the next section is hiring. You want to chat about hiring a little?
Yeah, I love it. I think we've nailed it.
I think we've nailed it too. We have an incredible team, but it wasn't always this way.
No way.
What was the first role that we hired?
The first role that we hired was it Pickpacker? Was it someone to help us pack in the warehouse?
No.
Was it the warehouse? No, I think it was. Yes, it was Jess.
No.
Was it Jet? No, it wasn't. It was Becky.
Yeah. Becky was our first hire.
Becky was our first hire. Number one. It was a crossover between those two because I remember Jess came in around the same time for a couple of days and then COVID hit.
Mm, yes.
And then we didn't see her for the longest time until we could have people come in again.
Yeah.
And then that's right. And then that's right. Rebecca came in to help us with customer service.
And pick packing.
She was amazing.
That was our first hire. Yeah. Someone said, aside from pick packing, what would your first hire be? Like, what would you suggest someone be their first hire? Beck started here before I did.
Yeah. Beck was the first employee of Stacks.
I was still working in recruitment and pick packing on my lunch break.
We still, Becky, if you're listening to this, we still love you. It's crazy because she earned a salary before we did, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I only started earning salary a year or two ago and you were probably employee number 5 or 6.
Yeah. Pick packing, I think, is like, so basically when it comes to, I know this is your interview, but when it comes to hiring, I think you just need to work out, like, it's going to be different for every business, I think, their first hire.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's supply demand. You hire for the position you need. I think for me, I've got a lot of friends that own businesses and I'm friends with a lot of other founders, and I think everyone is a little different, but my philosophy and approach to this always was I have to do everything at first. And when I'm struggling in a certain area that I can't cope with anymore, then I'll hire for that area.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my process the whole way through. So I remember when we needed to find someone for customer service and pick packing, it was a bit of a joint role because that's the area I couldn't cope with. Like, I couldn't be spending all the time doing that by myself. That's what we hired for. And that's sort of how it evolved. You know, I think you're silly if you're running a small startup business. For example, like the absolute smallest business, and you don't have a huge investment to put into it, and people think you got to go and hire a marketing manager, you got to go hire a head of this and a head of that and a marketing director and a full team. You're going to arrive there on Monday with a full team of experts, but no money that's coming in to pay them. It depends. Unless you know what you need to run and you know how to set up the company, that's a completely different conversation. But if you've just had this little startup and it's a small idea and you need to turn it into something, start super small, do it by yourself, give yourself 2 to 3 years to grow into it.
Drag your girlfriend into it.
She won't even realize. And, you know, you start small and you grow from there.
How do you hire the right staff members?
You have to be super clear on your personal values and the values for the company that you want. You know, we didn't get it right in the beginning. I remember we were hiring people and we were pitching the job to them.
Yes.
We were so determined
that's
to like
something we've really
sell the
flipped
dream.
Now. Mm.
That's where I think we went wrong, right?
When we would interview people, we would use it as like a PR opportunity for us. Like, we wanted them to leave the interview with us loving Stacks more than they did before. But that's not what an interview is. An interview is a discussion between both parties.
Well, we wanted people to love the job. We wanted people to love Stacks. We wanted people to love us. We wanted a, there was that movement of creating the perfect work culture. Everyone was always talking about the work culture and the work environment and creating the best experience. And when we wanted that, our delivery of that needed work.
Mm-hmm.
What we thought is, you know, we'd hire people and sell them the dream, hoping to convince them that this is the best place to work at, hoping that they'll come in and just love their job. Then we learned that that's the most incorrect way to hire people. You hire people based on their skills and their contribution first. I never look at a resume, really, to be honest. I look at, you know, the people's skill and what they have done just to gauge where they've been in their life.
It's not really to do with what school they went to. We don't know schools.
Well, I don't know any school in Sydney. In this environment, you don't really need a degree to work here. For me, it's about a person's attitude. And the number one question I want to get to in my mind, I don't always ask them this, but I try and determine, like, are they going to have our backs?
Yeah.
When we have to work later, when shit hits the fan, and I want to know if people are going to show up for us, like we'll show up for them. So one of the things that we changed was being very strict in what we are willing to tolerate and what we will accept. And if we could articulate that and be clear internally in the company and portray those values, we would be able to hire people that would fit into that mold.
You know, I think because my background is recruitment, you think I would have been able to easily hire people, easily interview people, but recruiters can't hire like there's a saying or kind of it's a fact in the industry. It's not a fact. It's a thought in the industry that recruiters struggle to hire for themselves. So like if you are working in a recruitment company and you're hiring for that company, it's hard for you to hire because the people don't last. And I thought about it and it just literally clicked. Sorry to take over your interview, but it just literally clicked that when you work in recruitment, I would interview these people and I'd be selling the job to them because all I needed to do was get them to accept the job. Then they would work at the job and then it wasn't my problem anymore. Once a client said yes to them, they said yes to the client. I was on to the next thing. And I think that's kind of how I was interviewing for Stacks because I would be selling them the job, not realizing that they would come and be in this job, but there were different things that weren't so glamorous that we didn't speak about, and then they weren't happy. So it's like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I've just had that click. That's why recruiters can't hire for themselves, because hiring internally, you just want them to say yes and you want to get it done. Whereas that's not how it works. You need to be honest about the work and the workload and the hours expected, and you need to have an open conversation about expectations.
I think it's important. I think you've absolutely nailed it. The other realization I've had is that it's up to us and it's up to me to mentor every single person that works in this environment so they can understand the culture from me.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they can understand the culture from, you know, their fellow colleagues. So I have this 2-week rule. I have this conversation with every new person that walks into our doors for the first time, and I'll set them at the table and I'll say, hey, I have zero expectations from you for the next couple of weeks. I want you to find your feet. I want you to absorb the culture. We have zero KPIs. I'm not interested in seeing huge results from you. I want you to understand how we do things. I want you to build relationships with your colleagues and your staff. They're going to teach you how I operate. They're going to teach you how this business operates. They're going to teach you how Matilda operates. And I take that period for me to get to know that person so that I can also work with them on their level and understand them, because everyone's different, right? And I think like that process is important because you give people time to settle in, but also you got to realize people need to develop into the role. I've seen some of our best staff, it's taken them, you know, almost 12 months to like, you know, reach their potential, or for us to even see like the absolute true value in what they've brought. Do you know what I mean?
I remember you gave an example once that you don't even want their desk or their laptop built or their computer built or anything, because you want them to have to build it themselves, have to ask their team for help, have to interact with the team, because that's so intimidating on a first day. But you like to put them in situations. It's not like some sort of like survivor shit. Like it's just like situations where you do have to interact with the people around you.
Yeah, we went through a stage when we first started, when someone would start, we'd have everything set up for them. You know, mm-hmm. They'd rock up on the day and like everything would be ready for them to go. Now we have everything there and I want people to set up their own computer. I want people to set up their, not build their desk, but like set up their space and, you know, find themselves and create themselves, because this is not just a job.
Mm.
It's a lifestyle job. You know, I always say this to people. I'm like, I want to see people here in, you know, 5 or 10 years. And
yeah.
I want people to migrate with us as we keep growing, you know, they'll grow.
We want people to celebrate wins if they happen after work hours. It's not just a 9 to 5.
Yeah. I mean, and there's certain areas in the company where I understand that it is a 9 to 5, and there's, you know, for some people it is just a uni or a casual job.
Yeah.
I'm referencing career jobs right now. I'm referencing people that have started at the bottom. I had an interview with one of our retail staff recently. Because whenever I spot potential, whenever I hear good things, I always invite them in for an interview so I can get to know them. And I had this conversation. I said to this girl, I said, I'm happy to bring you in like a mentoring opportunity. And I want you to float around and find yourself and find what's going to make you tick in your environment. Because when a young person or someone that's looking for a career job finds their space, and when they are confident in what they want to do, they'll thrive. And I think that's also a nice way to like introduce people into the workforce.
Yeah, absolutely. Giving people an opportunity to grow into the role.
Yeah.
Because like you said, sometimes it does take 12 months to see someone's true potential. As long as they fit and they're working really hard, you know that they're the right fit, you're willing to kind of grow with them.
Well, the other thing is like, I remember, and we probably spent a lot of time on hiring, but I remember-
We can make this like a 2-part if you want, right, as well.
Cool. I'm good to go. I'm enjoying offloading some ideas. Cool. So I remember when we hired Georgia,
mm-hmm.
We hired her to do customer service.
And so George is now
the product manager, one of our most senior staff. And I remember in our interview saying to her, yeah, we'll only need you for 1 or 2 days a week. you know, does that work for you? Blah, blah. And she was like, yeah, that's fine. Thank you. She never worked for 2 days a week. Her first week was a full week, and every other week after that.
7 days. She does work very hard.
Yeah, super hard. And she's progressed.
Yeah.
And now sits in a senior position as the brand's product manager.
A position that she's grown into.
Most of, you know, so many of our team have started literally pickpacking in the warehouse.
I think
have,
at the start as well, because that's all we could afford, yeah. You know. We couldn't be hiring these people with all these qualifications and all this experience and all this background. So we're lucky we have hired some really great people that have grown into the role that they're in now, and they're thriving.
And I think that's part of the essence of our internal structures. I think that's one of the beauties of our internal team.
I think as well, because you and I, we don't have qualifications. Did you study anything? We're just hard workers. And we, I mean, you're an absolute genius. I'm a hard worker. But we just put in the work, and then that's how we've gotten to where we are today. It's literally just been hard work and good, smart decisions. We don't have any qualifications, any real background that gives us the go ahead to go and do this. And I think that's kind of, we see the potential in people.
That's our thesis, you know, that's our reference. And I also want to say, I look at on a daily basis, I look at some amazing resumes that come my way. I've had some amazing interviews with incredible humans that have done wild things for huge companies, but they just haven't been the right fit for a young e-commerce orientated fashion and lifestyle brand.
Mm.
That's an interesting thing to navigate, because when you have years and years of corporate experience and you come into like an ever-changing, fast-moving digital and social media e-commerce fashion environment, a lot of that doesn't really fit in here.
It's a big adapt. Yeah. You have to really, it's a shift.
So that's a hard one for us, because, you know, I'm always looking for great people to join the team, but just because you might have an incredible resume doesn't mean you're going to have our back. That's one thing I always look at.
Have you ever had a mentor during your journey, or is there like professional mentor, or has there been people that have mentored you without even realizing?
I think I've been privileged in my life around, you know, the way I was raised, and in certain environments, there was always someone I would look up to, not necessarily a friend or a mentor, just someone I would look up to and look at that might have been successful in business. And I would try and form a relationship with them. I wouldn't necessarily sit there and they'd teach me things. But I remember one of the first instances of this was, there was this guy, and I don't know if you ever listened to this, his name's Kevin Attree. I used to train at a gym. I was like 18 or 19, and it was his family in Perth, and they used to own a little real estate agency. Super successful, super approachable at the gym. I would just watch them. Like, he was just the nicest guy. The family was the nicest people. And I wouldn't say infatuated, but I was inspired by this family. And I got to know him at the gym. I by the way, I haven't even told you the story. I'm thinking back now. And I built a relationship. Every now and then I would just sit with him and have a coffee, probably two or three times in my entire life. I try and pitch an idea or two to him, and they ended up buying some of the hoodies I used to sell. I think one of his daughters turned 21 and I DJed at their birthday party. So I built this really organic relationship with them. I wouldn't at all say we were closer friends, but I would just observe what they were doing. And I felt quite inspired. I remember actually when I was trying to find money to start Stacks, I went and asked him for a loan. And it was one of the most profound moments. And he said to me, he's like, no, I won't do this because I think money damages relationships. It's not going to help you.
You're a smart man.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even disappointed. I learned so much from that little conversation. He said, but what I will do is I'll buy two hoodies from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked there. And I walked away from that so proud. And I probably learned invaluable lessons from that experience. There was one family friend I had that was super, super successful. And he spent a lot of time with me, you know, again, just sharing their journey and sharing how he got to where he got to from absolutely nothing. So I've never really had like a mentor that taught me the 1+1 in business, but I surrounded myself with people that have done what I've wanted to do. I observed them. I asked humble questions and learned. Here's a funny one. I remember, I don't know why I was so obsessed with real estate. I walked into a guy's name is Rory O'Rourke, the owner of this, you know, very flamboyant old, I think he was 50s or 60s. He owned this real estate company. So I walked into the office and I was like, hey, I'd like to have a meeting with this guy. And I walked straight into his office and sat down with him. And I was like, hey, teach me about real estate. And he literally, it was the craziest thing. He gave me like this massive sales pitch, pulled out all these history books about, you know, all the properties he built, sat there with him for 2 hours, never met him before, never saw him again after. he planted crazy seeds in my mind, and he gave me 2 hours of his time and taught me about real estate. And I left there, and that was another firm.
You know, people are going to be coming into the stacks wanting this. I want the Rory treatment. I think there's something about you, though, that you do just have that, like, people will – you have that energy that's, like, confident and commanding, and I can totally get why he would just – true, hey, he would just sit down and share everything with you. Like, you kind of own the space even before you do, if that makes sense.
Thank you. I think it's important for you to know what you want in life. Yeah. But never be arrogant about it.
No, you're very driven, I think. And you're always just like open to learning. You still are now. You're one of the smartest people I know, and you're still open to learning.
So full of confidence tonight. I love you so much. Thank you. That's a good piece of advice. Like, one, you never know everything. It's one thing I said, you know, I just turned 34 the other day, and it's one thing I'm learning more and more. The older you get, the less you know. You realize, you know, when you're in your 20s, you think you know everything. When you're a teenager, you absolutely think you're a genius. And the old, and that's wisdom. You realize that for you to progress, you need to learn more. For you to grow, you need to become more humble and realize that other people around you are smart and they hold the keys. So I think it's important. And by the way, successful people want to teach. Once you have everything, once you have money, once you have a success, what's the next thing for you to do is you want to give back, and you want to, it's a different kind of flex when you can teach a young kid to do these things, right? So if you're young and you listen to this, go and find super successful people. Don't DM them on Instagram and say, hey, can I have a coffee? If you see someone at the gym, like, build an organic relationship and just be like, hey man, you're super inspiring. Don't go and ask for something. Just like, watch people, study them, learn from what they're doing without like getting into their space. And hopefully the laws of attraction will attract you to them, and you can sit one day and have a coffee and pick their brain.
Yeah, absolutely. People like to pick your brain on marketing. So we'll just do a couple of marketing questions, and then we'll cut it, I guess, because we're flying through these questions.
You're such a great host. Maybe you should do this more often.
Thank you so much. The best piece of advice for starting an e-commerce brand with little budget for marketing. How do we market an e-commerce brand when we got no money?
I think these days it's really hard. I think the great thing we have here is the ability to connect on social media. You can decentralize communication by literally sharing it online. Everyone's always focused on picking up what the algorithm is or whatever, you know, the next big trend is going to be. But build your brand with the closest friends around you. Try and influence people in your environment first. You know, find 10 people to love your product. Convince them. Find 20 people after that. You know, play the long game, because while you're focusing on the 10, the 20, and the 30, the first 10 are talking to their 10 best friends if you left an experience on them. And 10 times 10 is 100. So before you know it, by the time you've hit your 30th people, you might be on 300 or 3,000, because the multiplication of the equation will keep growing. Where a lot of people are just focusing on trying to post something on social and hoping it goes. But in every conversation you have with people, edify your product, edify your brand, talk about your vision, talk about your dream. And if you do that for long enough, everyone around you will believe in it.
I think as well, just on the social side of things, you have to understand the power that every single person has on social media. If you have one follower, you can influence that one person. If you've got 100, you've got 100 followers that are listening to what you say. So it's like, you don't need these accounts or influencers with this massive amount of following. Sure, they might have more reach, but you still have reach no matter what number following you have. Like, if you have one follower on Instagram, you are able to influence them. Also, like TikTok as well. TikTok has, you can post a video and it can be like the shittest quality video ever, and it has the potential to go viral and change your life, literally. So try different things. Post on TikTok, post on Instagram. There's like that cringe factor. I remember we were talking about that before. Like, yeah, Everyone's a little bit cringe before they're successful. That is so true, because I have seen the DMs that you have sent some of these people trying to make a sale, and I cringe. But it works. Just listen to that. Every single person is a little bit cringe before they become successful. I think that is so true.
And forget about being cringe. Just focus on the mission.
But that's what I mean. Like, you don't have to overthink it so much all the time.
I always say, you know, overthinking kills dreams. If I ever had to write a book, one of my books is probably going to be called, you know, Start Small. Stop thinking about owning the big warehouse. Stop thinking about trying to get to the end game. You just have to start small.
You told me your book was going to be called something else.
I said one of them. I said one. Start small.
Profanities. Which form of marketing do you think gives the best return? Influencers, Meta being like Instagram, Facebook, or Google.
I don't think there's any one that you can just run by itself. I still think there's such great value in working with influencers because people buy from people.
Yeah.
That the one of the most important things to realize is, you know, an influencer is a person that is willing to put themselves in front of a lot of people to talk about your product. They're not just another channel. Once you can tap into that concept, I think your best return is always going to come from other people marketing your product. And I'm not talking about people with millions of followers. I'm talking about someone with 1,000 followers that has a great personality because, again,
that truly loves your brand.
Focus on this concept, you know, the laws of multiplication, 10 times 10, 100 times 100, 1,000 times 1,000. You do those calculations and realize that if you have someone with 1,000 followers that are truly engaged and you give them a product and they absolutely love your product, genuinely love your product, and their 1,000 followers love your product, you know, 1,000 times 1,000, do the math. But this is something that has to happen over time. You can't put anything online and expect it to sell by itself overnight. It just doesn't work. Your best return is going to be the work you put in front of other people. And what I mean by that is I would rather go knock on doors and try and hustle and sell products face-to-face than rely on an algorithm to pick up something and sell it.
So you would say like pop-ups and things like that?
I would say pop-ups. Here's a sales 101. People buy from people. You have to be able to sell your product to another person and then you use the different platforms to accompany that. That's my philosophy and that's what I'll always believe in.
I think a lot of people as well, from what I've seen, if they're trying to start, you know, a business or sell a product, they don't have a confident pitch in their product. The thing, you have to actually believe in your product. You have to have a point of difference. You have to have a reason as to why people should be purchasing the product from you. But like sometimes you ask people and they get like all shy or don't want to talk about it. It should be something you're so proud of. I think that's when there was in one of the audiobooks that I've been listening to, said you don't how to like lead people or sell to people. And they said they don't have to believe that this is the best thing in the world, but they just have to believe that you believe that.
Yeah.
And I think that you need to be confident in your product. You need to be able to sell it and that confidence will radiate through and people will catch it. It's contagious. People will believe you.
I love that so much, Babs. I think you've completely nailed that. I think if you're not willing to buy your own product, why would you expect someone else to?
Yeah.
If you don't believe in yourself, how can someone else believe in you? A lot of the time, I know for a fact when people were buying my ties and my hoodies in the beginning, they were doing it because of me. They were supporting me.
They believed in you.
They believed in me. They were supporting this kid that was having a crack at it. And I didn't give a fuck. You know, there was a whole bunch of people that were probably laughing at me and making fun and talking shit. I know they were. We know they were. But it doesn't matter because even in today's age, with all the competition in one of the most saturated markets, which is activewear, I shop every single day for our VIPs, our customers that believe in us. When I'm building a collection, when I'm building a show, I'm not worried about the people that don't know about us, don't care about us. I'm working for the people that believe in us and care about us because that's the relationship we have with them,
yeah,
with one another. They support us, we support them, and before you know it, that will grow over time. But the one piece of advice I always love to leave people with is give yourself enough time. It takes time to build these things and don't have an end date on what you're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't have to compare your journey to someone else's. It's the same as the chapter thing in the books that I talk about. You never compare your chapter to someone else's chapter because you don't know what number the chapter is in their story.
I think it's super important. All right, I love that.
We had a couple left, but I think that's a nice way to close off.
I think we'll do it.
That was fun. Did you enjoy that?
I did. I really hope that people get some good value out of this one.
They were all questions that were submitted, so I know that at least those people were going to be enjoying it.
Not our usual style for a podcast, guys, but I really hope and truly believe that you enjoyed this one. And whatever you're starting, Till and I want you to know that you can fucking do it. If we can do it, trust us, you can do it. And, you know, wishing you well and make sure you take the first step.
Thanks, guys.
Love y'all.
Bye.